Good afternoon. My name is Vanessa Williams. Today is Saturday, May 30th, 2026. I am part of the Oral History Summer School cohort of 2026. I'm sitting here in Hudson Hall in Sage Carter's office, and I'm just excited to talk to you today. Sage, please introduce yourself.
Hi, Vanessa. I'm Sage Carter, and I reside in Hudson. I've lived here for 17, almost 18 years, and I've worked at Hudson Hall for over 10 years, which is crazy. I'm a theater person and mom.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Yeah. I just wanted to begin by first asking you to share about your name.
My mom and dad were pretty sure they were going to have a boy, so they had a boy's name picked out, William Wesley, and my last name's Carter. But then I was a girl, and they didn't have a name. And so I didn't have a name for, like, I don't know, a couple of days, I guess. And then someone suggested Sage, and my mom really liked it. So then she said, okay. But I think it might have been because of Scarborough Fair, which was popular at the time, which is a Simon and Garfunkel song, that the chorus is parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. And I think there were a lot of rosemaries and sages during that period. So, don't know that for a fact, but...
Excellent. No, that's amazing to know. Thank you.
Yeah. And it rhymes with lots of things. The word sage.
This is true. Yes. Yeah. So. Yeah. No, one of the advantages of having, one of those types of names.
Yeah.
I heard you mentioning your family. I guess, do you have siblings? Or
I have a sister. Okay. She lives up here as well. She lives in the town of Gallatin, which is about 20 minutes away. Mm-hmm. And she has a store like three doors down from Hudson Hall. Where she's a jeweler. She makes jewelry. Mm-hmm. And she and I both had our kids 2 weeks apart. So we had sons, and so those boys grew up together. They were in different school districts, but that was really nice.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, thank you for that. Yeah. So you mentioned that you've been in Hudson for 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what brought you in, your family.
My husband and I moved up when our son was one. So we were living in Brooklyn and had a baby, and we had to either move to a bigger, better apartment or leave Brooklyn. It was sort of a choice. And we my family was already up here. And so there was this little tiny house in the edge of town, and we put in a ridiculously low bid thinking this will never happen. And I guess they were desperate to sell because they accepted our offer. So then this is where we moved to. But it was good because it was nice to be closer to family. You know, and for my son and my sister's son to grow up together was really nice. Mm-hmm. Have that, you know.
Your sister's a jeweler.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she still owns a shop, you said.
Yes, Shauna Lee is her name. She makes silver and gold jewelry. It's very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excellent. I'm trying to think where to go next. I'm really intrigued because you said you worked at Hudson Hall for the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Can you fill in the first 7 years? What were you doing before?
Uh-huh. I was, when we moved up here, I was a freelance, theater, designer. And so I worked in projections design. So I would go wherever, I was just freelance. So I would go wherever there was a show. So I would go to Chicago when I lived in New York City, I worked in New York City a lot, Chicago, LA, overseas too sometimes. And then, so I kept doing that, but then I had a baby and it was really hard to travel all the time. So I walked in here not long after we moved up and I told the previous executive director, hey, if you ever fix that theater up that you have upstairs, let me know, because I'd love to come and do a show here someday. But at that time, half the building was still hadn't been restored. So the theater was not operational yet. And anyway, and then so that was that. And then they called me. Gary was the first executive director, and then Tammy was his co-director. And she and Gary called me up and took me out for a coffee. And they were like, so we're doing a... No, that's not how it happened. Sorry, I have to go back. What happened was they said, I found out they were doing a TED Talk here upstairs, and it hadn't been restored yet. And so I wrote in to say I'd love to volunteer because I knew I couldn't afford a ticket. And so then they brought me in for a cup of coffee and they were like, well, actually, would you volunteer to stage manage the whole thing? And I was like, okay, let me go talk to my family, because I knew what time commitment that was going to be, not insignificant. And everybody said, yeah, cool, go for it. So then I was here working on that probably, I'd have to look back, but it was probably like over the course of about 4 weeks, putting it all together. And then the day of the show, and we filmed it, and we had to do everything with generators. There was no HVAC, and it was very hot, and we had, I mean, there was no CFO on the building. It was like a little crazy. We got a temporary certificate of occupancy from the city in order to have all the people in here. The balcony had had a fire in it, so it was really unsafe on one half of the balcony. So, but I had to have the crew up there because we needed it. So they were all on the other side, and we had to safety tape it. It was just, it was a little crazy. But it was fun. It was really fun. So,
sounds good.
It was cool. Mm-hmm. So, and then, so I was volunteering here. And then when they finally raised the money to restore the theater upstairs, they called me in again and said, so, we're going to have a theater one of these days. You want to come work with us? I was like, yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I had never, I mean, not since I was like 15, had a normal job, you know? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. where I would like, you know, go into an office. Yeah, so it was unusual for me. But I was like, yeah, let's do it. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I started the week they opened the bids to do the construction upstairs.
Okay.
With the contractor's bids. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've committed the cardinal sin of oral history, I believe, in that I were instructed to leave some pause time after, like, you know, you've shared a little bit. I guess I'm just so intrigued by your story. Oh, my goodness. So, when you hear me pause later, mm-hmm. Throughout the rest of the duration of this interview, just know that that is additional, like, processing or thinking time for you, and for me to think about, you know, what other follow-up questions that we've got here.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for bearing with me. excuse me. You mentioned that since you were 15, you haven't worked a regular job. Can you share more about, like, I guess your road to, you describe yourself as a theater person, and obviously, like, with your... the origin story of your work with Hudson Hall. How is that road, I guess, you know, to when you were 15 or so to now, like, gotten you there, I guess? I'm curious. If you can articulate it.
It's a pretty, I think, unusual story. I ran away from home when I was 15 and lived on the streets for a while. And then I moved down to Arlington, Virginia, where my father was living. And I stayed with him for about a year and doubled up on classes and got a high school diploma. And then I needed a job. And a friend of mine's parents had a mom and pop slide shop. They did projections for small trade shows and, like, manager meetings where they were trying to get people to, like, now everything is done in video, but back then it was all on film and it was on slideshows. And so I started working for them and I learned all the departments. So everything from, like, answering the phones to making the artwork to using the large format cameras to cutting, hand cutting masks on Rubylith, all the things. So I worked for them full-time for, I guess, 2 years. And I was like, I really was feeling my lack of education. And, like, that I didn't have that foundational, I don't know, call it Western civ. Like, I had never read a philosophy book. I didn't really know history. Like, I had missed so much. Mm. So I did go back to, went to a community college down there. And I did a year and a half and just kind of caught myself up with education. And then, what did I do after that? Well, then I can't honestly remember. I just did odd jobs, whatever I could get. And then I moved back to New York City. So when I came back to New York, I was 21. Mm-hmm. And my sister and I had had a jewelry business. And we lost the business in a fire down in Virginia. It was in Virginia at my aunt's house. But we lost. And my sister was in college at the time. So I moved back to New York City. And a friend of a friend knew a woman who did slideshows for theater. And I went over there and I was like, here's my resume. And she hired me on the spot. She had never found anybody who had actual practical experience. Everyone she was getting was coming out of college with a theater major degree, but they didn't know how to, like, physically do the thing. And so she gave me a retainer that day. It's like, I'm starting a show in a couple of weeks. And that was that. And so I worked with her for, gosh, I don't know, 12 years maybe? A long time. Mm-hmm. And then I went freelance. But I continued to work with her whenever she had a project. But then I was designing shows on my own and or assisting people with their shows. Sometimes I would just get hired to, like, make the artwork for, like, one piece of a show. Like, she was doing a... Wendell Harrington was my mentor. And she was doing a show and she needed to project, like, a valley in a forest in all four seasons. And so I had to, like, painstakingly make... I kind of made it in Photoshop, but, like, the seasons change over the course of the opera that she was working on. So, like, you know, I would get called in for, like, targeted projects like that. Yeah. And then I... Yeah, so that's what I did. And then I moved up here, and I was still doing that, but I had a baby, and I was like, oh, this is really hard to make a living and be traveling all the time. So, mm-hmm. yeah, so when they offered me a job, I was like, yeah, cool. Mm-hmm. And now I do all the shows. But I don't do very much projections anymore. A little bit, mm-hmm. you know, but not much. Yeah.
Thank you for that. Oh, what a journey. Like, yeah.
It's a little kind of unusual.
Yeah, because I'm, you know, thinking about, yeah.
When I work with... we work with a lot of youth, but I always try to really instill in them that if you come without too much ego and, like, you're willing to get the coffee and sweep the floor, you can create almost any career you want if you're willing to start at the beginning. You know, I feel like a lot of people want to jump to the end, to, like, being the boss or being the, you know, having your own company or all the things, but... For me, you know, I mean, not having a proper education or a traditional, I'll call it a traditional education, wasn't a barrier because I was like, I was hungry to learn, you know? So I would go in at the beginning and just absorb anything anyone was willing to teach me. So that was, that worked out well for me.
I'm really struck by you mentioning the youth work that happens mm-hmm. here. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, it's. I find it really meaningful work. We do a lot of workshops for little kids. So we do art workshops. Over the, you know, time that I've been here, we've done circus, dance, movement. We had a yoga and art making workshops. We've done a lot of art making workshops, paper making, painting, sculpting. We've done cooking classes. And drama. We have a lot of drama classes and stuff. And we really target kids between the age of, like, well, we just did a baby and me, like a mommy and me or guardian and me, baby movement class, so everything from babies. But then you start to lose them at junior high. They stop participating. I guess, like, their families can't make them go anymore. Or, you know, we do work with the school district, so after school programs. But then by junior high, they're pretty independent, and they want to do their own thing. So we started in 2018. We started a workforce development program. It's now called Culture Works, where we work with teens and give them workforce training. And so now we've, it just has allowed us to really reach like the full spectrum of kids in the district. And we also, when we have artists come through, like mostly musicians, if they're willing and able, we will do workshops with the professional musicians, and we'll bring Hudson City School District band students over to work with those musicians, which is really fun too. Yeah, but the Culture Works program is, it's special. We've run it in a bunch of different, I'd say, areas of focus. Everything from like getting jobs in the service industry to now we're doing a lot of work where we're training the teens to run all of the equipment in this building. So we're teaching them lights, sound, video, and then giving them access to that equipment to make their own things. And then we continue to hire them over the course of the year wherever we can. So, yeah, and it's, you know, it's part of it is to say, you know, there's so many, I guess, like me as an example, there's so many jobs that you might not know exist. So when we do the Culture Works program, we'll bring in professional artists or professional, not always artists at all, but people from different areas of life to say, this is what I do, and this is how I got there, and just to really try to open their eyes about all the things in the world that you might imagine that you could do.
As you were sharing about Culture Works, and like thinking back to a message that you said that you imparted like earlier in the interview about, I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but you know, if you just come with the tools, if you come with the humility and are willing to do, you know, start again, paraphrasing like from the ground up, right? Mm-hmm. I'm hearing that really come through in like the work of Culture Works, right?
Yes. It's funny, one time we ran it and, you know, we go around in the beginning, like, what do you want to be when you grow up kind of thing. And one of the kids at the beginning of the course was like, oh, I'm going to be an NBA star. And everybody's like, yeah, right. I mean, not that you're not good at basketball, but the chances of that, no one knocked him down, but, you know, you're thinking in your head. And then by the end, he was like, I might want to go into management, like managing these athletes. And so that was really cool for me. You know, it was like, okay, like you have a plan B. If you don't make it as an, you know, professional athlete, you see that there's lots of other ways to support the sport that you love and have a job working in it that you could do, you know. So that was really cool. Just one small example, but we try to do a lot of confidence building, communication skills, help them write a resume. Sometimes the only... A lot of these kids have to work and have jobs, but sometimes the only thing they have to put on their resume is this program. But it's a place to start. It's a place to start. And then we also do try to connect them with open jobs in town. So a lot of restaurants and coffee shops and retail have hired students out of our program over the years, which has been really great.
The more you share, the more it feels evident to me that arts, I've done so much like for your life, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's a practice that you love to share with youth. And again, we've been zooming in on that. But are there other thoughts around like this relationship between youth work and arts that you haven't been able to express now or up until now?
You know, it's so frustrating when you look at public education in America and how the arts, how do I say this? When you look back at the history of humanity, what are the things you remember? What are the things that leave a lasting impression? And I'm not saying that everybody can be a Michelangelo, but the history of humanity is told through our arts. And every time a school district is up against not having enough funding, the first thing they do is cut the arts. And or cut back on students' access to creative thinking. And research has shown over and over and over again that access to the arts is the thing that can really give, especially students who maybe can't learn in a really traditional way, who maybe can't memorize things so well, but you give them music and suddenly they can do math. Like in my work, I use math all day long, and I go volunteer at the school, and everybody's like, I can't do math, I'm afraid of math. I'm like, you absolutely can. Can you sing a song? Can you count to four? Can you, you know, there's so many paths to academic success that arts can lead the way on, and we just don't embrace that. I mean, there's other, I think, cultures around the world that do a lot more of that, but here in America, we really don't, and it's sad. So that is to say that I love being part of an organization that offers that, that maybe students wouldn't get in some other capacity or some other way to give them access to the arts. And all the arts. There's culinary arts. I mean, it's not just being a musician or being a painter, or there's just so many approaches.
I'm really moved by all that you're saying. I mean, I'm weaving how your personal story has led you to where you are now with Hudson Hall. Okay, so right now it's May 30th, 2026. Mm-hmm. It's a Saturday, rainy Saturday, here in Hudson. Tell me about Hudson Hall. Actually, what's going on today at the hall?
Well, we've been hosting Oral History Summer School, which has been super fun. Actually, today is a little bit of a quiet day. Last night we had an opera. The work we do with youth is probably 10% of what we do, you know, so, cause we're presenting, music, dance, opera, theater, we have two fine art galleries. We, do workshops for adults. It just runs the gamut. Because the theater itself is so flexible, the seats aren't affixed to the floor. So we can move them and like use that space in an infinite variety of ways. We're not trapped by having a, you know, fixed seating. We do have a proscenium stage. It's quite small, relative, to other theaters. So we don't have like really high ceilings where we can fly scenery in and out. The wing space on the sides of the stage are quite small. So presenting dance, you can't really do that on the stage because the dancers would run into the wall when they're trying to exit the stage. So we can do that on the floor and the round. So we're super flexible, but that just means we can support all these different types of art forms. We're about to, we also do movies, so we have a screening this coming week. We have a few concerts coming up, and we're installing a large-scale art project upstairs that's a 25-foot hoop of projection screen, an artist is coming in to install that, and he has a film called Ghost Dance for America that we'll be screening upstairs for 2 weeks. So it's just a huge variety. Mm-hmm. Sorry, what was the question?
I was just asking to tell us about today at Hudson. Oh, no, right. You did.
Yeah.
Thought it was, you painted the vivid picture that I was hoping you would. I appreciate it.
Like, but today's quiet. Yeah. Compared to, but yesterday we had an audience of 330 people upstairs for the opera.
Yeah, easy. So. Oh, you just said yes for the opera. Okay, yeah. Perfect. Yeah. Actually, let me do a time check.
This is going off, and I just want to make sure it's nothing.
Yeah, no worries.
Critical. No, not good.
I am curious about what your hopes for Hudson Hall are. Are there a particular it could be what kind of initiatives that you or programs that you want to see happen here? I'll just pause it there. What are your hopes for us and all?
Well, you know, I think that this this building is such a community asset that we just expended so much money fixing it reopening the full building to the whole community was only 10 years ago. So I guess, and it had sat derelict for a few decades prior to that. So I think my first hope is that long after I'm gone, people hold together to hold the building itself together, because it's easy for these old buildings to fall into disrepair, and it takes a lot of sort of constant love and attention to keep them fully functioning for everybody. And I guess the other half of that is to keep the doors open to everybody in the future. I think it's something that's been a part baked into our mission since sort of the founding group of citizens banded together and bought the building from a developer to save it from getting knocked down. Has been to always just have the doors open to everybody. And I think we don't necessarily tell that story so well to the public, mm-hmm. but when you're here and you spend time here, you see it evidenced and lived. Like, the building really does embrace, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking about children, and all the different kinds of arts and artists. And when we do shows, we always try to hold blocks of tickets for community members and groups that we work with who might not otherwise be able to afford to come. And we you know, give blocks of tickets to the Fireman's Home and to, you know, different, you know, we work really closely with Camp Hill Hudson, and they do a play every year here on the stage, which is super wonderful. I think that's really it. It's just holding this place, together and keeping the doors wide open. But at the same time, we have high aspirations. I mean, we're doing, I think, pretty serious work, sometimes. And we, you know, it's not always serious work, but, we put our heart behind everything we do, and we're often elevating, artists who are maybe just getting started or need a place, a nurturing place to build something. So we do a lot of residencies, and we work to help artists get grant funding to support work and then give them a space to build that work. So we do a lot of that. And through that, that's almost entirely with local artists. So we're really trying to provide space for them. So, and that's really gratifying and wonderful work to do, you know. Like, I do like the work with the kids, but supporting local artists in sort of maybe taking that next step, like, and even with our jazz festival, like, we can't pay the kinds of fees that Newport Jazz pays or whatever. So we're always trying to catch an artist right as they're like about to go viral, I'll say, you know, or like right as they're about to win that Grammy. And it's been so exciting to see how many have come through here, and now we're seeing them at Newport, and we're seeing them win the Grammy, and we're, it's just like, oh my God, we worked with them when they were like just starting out, and now look at them, they're huge. Yeah. And it's been like, that's a lot of the work we do with the opera projects, the big ambitious opera projects that we do, we particularly work with this one director who lives in town, and he's really, been focused on capturing these artists as they're like about to just be huge and then too expensive for us to afford.
Don't forget, because
our budgets are small. I mean, and to be clear, like we only have, I think at max capacity with the chairs we own and the space we have, if sight lines are perfect for a show, we can only fit like 380 people upstairs. So it's not, you know, huge. And if you're doing Dance in the Round or something where the sight lines are compromised, you might have only be able to fit an audience of 150. Mm-hmm. So it's not huge, you know. So, yeah, that's a limitation that we can't change.
We can't. We're giving these tickets to the firefighters. They can't be breaking fire code while they're in the building.
Yeah, please, no. Exactly. Because they will know. Exactly.
As you've been speaking about Hudson Hall, I keep on hearing the we, the collective. Uh-huh. I'm curious about the team here that you work with.
It's, you know, that's funny because Gary was the first executive director that I worked with. He really instilled that in me. Mm-hmm. He was like, this is not personal. It's not about any individual. It's like us collectively as a team. And so he really set that vision from the very beginning, and I really appreciated that. And everyone I've worked with since has really come with that, and I think also left with that. We have a really small team. We're five people plus a couple of part-time people. We were six, but a young woman who was working with us just left for a job that I think is perfect for her. So I'm excited for her, but you know, we haven't replaced that position yet. So we have a new executive director, Adam Weiner, who has been with us, 6 months, I guess, full time, but he started, part time before that. So, you know, just kind of, a slow transition with our previous executive director. So there's Adam, we have Caroline Lee, who's been our communications and marketing director. She started right after I started, so she's also been here almost 10 years. And then Liz Broadfoot, she's our development director. And then we have Adam Netsky. So we have two Adams right now, which is funny. But Adam Netsky is our production person. He basically runs the lights, the sound, the video, all the systems, which is awesome. And moves all the chairs and tables around endlessly. Sorry, Netsky. but also part of his job is to really, is to be the liaison with the artists and help them, get here, you know, identify where they're staying, really like take care of them while they're on the ground here, which is, and he also installs all of our exhibitions. So yeah. It's a big job. So, yeah. And then part-time we have Emel Mosley, who's, she is helping to administer most of our community workshops and then also doing bookkeeping and office management. So she's amazing. And her mom actually was on the first committee that, like, tried to save this building. So she grew up in this building, and her mom still teaches many, many classes here, and she runs Operation Unite New York, who we partner with on many, many things, including Kwanzaa. We do a big, huge Kwanzaa every year, which is really fun. So, yeah. And then, and we have another part-time bookkeeper, which is Matt Parker. So I think that's everybody. Oh, well, and actually, my son has a summer job here helping with the box office. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. as you've been describing the team, and like a, it's like a, you know, 1,000 foot like overview of the many different like arts projects and programs that like operate here. I've been really curious about like your memories, like you know, specific memories that you've got that are particularly like are meaningful, I guess. So I will say, you know, share a memory or a, you know, I don't want to, you know, give you like what is the most important one.
Yeah, that's no, big, gosh. But there's so many.
Yeah,
so many. Gosh. So I knew our new executive director before he got this job because we had presented him as a choreographer and dancer a number of times over the years, and so I had known him for quite a long time. But he came to us with a proposition, maybe it was 2017 or 18. It was really soon after we had done the restoration upstairs. And Hudson Hall used to run a citywide festival in December, the first Saturday of December, called Winter Walk. We only recently stopped being the primary producing entity, but for 27 years we ran it. And Adam was like, we should do some sort of pantomime at Winter Walk that includes all of the kids' workshops that you guys do and all the, you know, community members who want to participate. And here's what I want to do. I want to mash up the Rip Van Winkle story with the Nutcracker Suite. And I'll have my professional dancers will tell the overarching story and the interstitial when Rip falls asleep / Clara's dream sequences will be done by all the children in the community presenting whatever they've learned. So it's like the hip-hop kids will come out and do a show, or the circus program will come and show off their circus skills. And I was just looking at the video just the other day of it. And so we did that for 3 years. But I was looking at the video, and at the very end, Elena Mosley, who runs Operation Unite, had all of her Kumba dancers, and Adam had all of his professional dancers, and we had this, we called it an emotional holding pen, but we down front, in front of the stage, we roped it off with, like, cones, and then we got all this white gauze to make it look like snowdrifts, and we held all the children in this, like, area so that they'd be ready, one, to get up on the stage, but also the room was packed, and if you wanted to have your kid ready, you needed to corral them somehow. So we held them in this, like, area. And at the end, all the dancers came down off the stage and were dancing through the audience, and all the kids got up. I mean, there were, because it was mostly standing room, there were probably 500 people upstairs. And everybody's dancing and laughing and smiling, and it's just amazing. It was really cool. And it was every age. You know, it was, I mean, everything from little babies to 90-year-olds in the room. And it was cool. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it really reifies, like, that, you said earlier that Hudson Hall is a community asset.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I guess that feels like it, that embodies, like, that,
yeah,
that spirit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's pretty, you know, another time we were presenting, the Badilla family, who live here in town, Pamela Badilla raised, I want to say, 11 kids, and I think all of them are artists. So one weekend, we decided to present, like, as much of the family as we kind of could. So we did the, Pamela has a theater troupe, so she made a play, and the play had, as always, she does these every year, but they're incredible, she always has, I mean, every age represented. Literally, like, the last one that they just did at the school, one of her daughters had a baby in a pack on her back and was dancing, and, you know, and then all the way up to, like, 95-year-olds in the play. So we were doing that play over 3 days. And then we also had her son, who's a rap artist named Young Paris. We presented him in concert. And then the next night, we also presented Lady Moon and the Eclipse, one of her other kids' projects, which includes, like, all of her daughters. So, and the whole family, they made all the sets, all the costumes for the play, and then the performances were super elaborative. And not only was every generation, every race, class, like creed of people in Hudson represented on stage, but the audiences as well, you know? So it's just like really, you know, affirming to like have like just everybody together, you know? And I feel like a lot of times theater spaces don't always do that, you know? So that those, it's just, it's fun.
Yeah.
And I mean, I will say like then we'll do a concert and it'll be, you know, demographically like almost all white and over 60. So it just, you know, really depends. But then sometimes when you get these shows and it just really draws in everybody, it's really exciting. And the opera series we're doing has been drawing a younger and younger audience, which is exciting because opera is like a art form that has had, I think, a difficult time kind of capturing the next generation, especially the hyper online generation who are just like watching TikTok. But if we can get them to come out for a 3-hour opera, it's pretty exciting.
So I think we're closing in at about 40 minutes. I am happy. Well, I want to truly turn it over to you. If there's, you know, anecdotes or thoughts that you wanted to continue, you know, previously. I've, you know, got some other directions I'm happy to take us, but I want to make sure that you don't have, I mean, as much as a 1-hour interview can capture it.
Was just talking the other day with a gentleman who was part of that original committee of trying to raise the money to buy the building, to save the building. And I'm not sure if the archive has kind of captured this history. So I think that it would be nice for Hudson, the city of Hudson, to hold on to that history. And I'm not going to try to get all the dates right because I won't. But I think it was the late 80s. In the early 1960s, this building was the original city hall. And the police station was here, and the city government, the common council, met here in this building. And the second floor was town hall. And the city, the building had fallen into terrible disrepair. It was going to be really expensive to fix it. So they took all their archives, and they took all their furniture, and they moved up to the 500 block and left the building derelict. And it just continued to fall into disrepair. There were like hordes of pigeons living in the rafters, and there had been a fire. Well, that happened later, but there was a fire in the balcony that had done a lot of damage. And a developer had bought it from the city at some point and was sitting on it, like hadn't decided to do anything. But the way I've been told is that there was a beautiful Worth Hotel in the 200 block of Warren Street, and it got knocked down. And citizens got really scared that the same would happen to this building. So they got together and they formed a committee. And I mean, I have to tell you, most of Warren Street was boarded up at this time. I mean, this city was had really fallen on rough times. But there were a group of creative young people, young 30s, moving up here. And a lot of antique dealers were coming into the area. They were buying these really cheap properties, and in some cases using them to warehouse antiques that they would sell at shops in the city or whatever. But they started coming up. The Red Dot, which is on this block, was like, I think, the first business to open on this block in like who knows how long. Anyway, the building was empty, and citizens went to the owner and said, how much would it cost to buy it? And the guy was like, I'll sell it to you for $90,000. And everybody was like, oh my God, that's so much money. And the state of the building is a disaster. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to try. And so all these young, you know, people with new families and older people too, like banded together and started trying to raise money. So they would have these fundraisers. And the story that I heard, was that Carrie Haddad, who's an illustrious art dealer in town, she has a fantastic gallery up the street. She used to be just directly across the street. So in those days, she had an art gallery across the street. She got Kiki Smith to curate an exhibition in her space, and all of the proceeds from the exhibition went into the fund to buy the building. And her husband, Nick, got into the building and figured out somehow how to turn on the lights, because, I mean, like, nothing had been turned on in this building in probably 20 years. But he figured it out. And so they had a countdown, and everyone was out on the street. And at the right time, he turned on the lights, and the building lit up for the first time in years. And everyone was like, could see the potential, right? And I think that was sort of the beginning. And it just kind of snowballed from there. And so they did raise the money to buy the building. And then they were going for their first, I think, big grant to stabilize the building. And they needed a community partner to sign on to it, to say, yeah, this is like a valid initiative and we're behind it. And so they went to Elena and Greg Mosley, who had Operation Unite. And that was also in a building just across the street, or maybe a couple doors down. Anyway, they said, we'll sign on if you promise that this isn't going to become some elitist artistic space and it will always be open for everybody. And Doug Thorne and Bill Ebel and all the other people who were on the board at that time were like, yeah, you bet. That's what we're in for. And so they signed it. They got the grant. They got a new roof. And just corner by corner, the building was saved over many, many years. And eventually they had enough stabilization to hire an executive director, and that was Gary. And he spent the next 18 years fundraising, because he only, like, his office was in the vault, in the bank vault that's in the West Room. And, like, they had this one little space where they could do shows, you know, and you could only fit, like, 40 people. And so he just, and then he finally did it, and he and Tammy got it across the finish line to raise enough money to do the rest of the building. I mean, not them, it was everybody. I mean, so many boards, community members, people really gave a lot. And then once it was, like, going to be done, Gary's like, all right, I did what I came to do. I'm stepping down. And Tammy, I'm going to give you the reins, and you can build the artistic future of this space that we've just saved. And so then Tammy, who had been with Merce Cunningham, and she had worked at BAM for a long time, and she had worked at the Fisher Center as well, been the executive there. And so she did, and she just, like, we got going. And so it was like 10 years. And now we have Adam, a new generation of artistic influence and stuff. So it's just a long history, and it took every corner of the town to save it, and a lot of donors and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And I guess that's why I was sort of saying my hope for the future is to maintain that thing that these citizens came together to do, you know. And I just think it's really cool, you know. And I think that kind of effort happens in small towns all over the country, you know. This is just our story here in this town.
What a story. I'm edge of my seat. Oh. I loved it. Maybe that's just the hyper local historian in me that's just appreciates hearing stories like that. Thank you for sharing.
There are spaces like that in DC too that I know have had that arc of history.
Yeah, it's amazing how you can have, you know, two very different geographically located things that the story of scrappy
citizens just being like, this is important. Yes. We want to save this. Yeah. Let's get it together and we'll do it.
Wow. I'm just right now I'm just sitting with how meaningful, like, this, you know, particular space is on, it's on Warren Street. And you've, you know, identified some other places. What other places draw you about Hudson?
Well, I would say the library. It was an armory before. But it's just a beautiful building. Mm-hmm. And it was restored in, I can't remember when. And then the library took, because the library used to be in a totally falling down building that was, before it was the library. What was it? Someone else can tell this story because I don't. Yeah, I think it was a school or maybe a home for orphans. It might have been an orphanage. But anyway, so they moved into the armory. But that's a really beautiful building. The basilica down on the riverfront is also just a beautiful, beautiful old building. So, yeah, what happened, I guess, and again, like other historians can tell the story better than me, but this town had only a little bit of urban renewal. Mm-hmm. In that sort of 70s where all of the old architecture and towns up and down the Hudson River and got just like, they just tore down all the old stuff and put up new, like huge, you know, project buildings and, you know, just horrible, sad, concrete buildings. We didn't have it. We had some of that. But then when people saw what was happening, well, it was twofold. Partly the town was so depressed that a lot of the old architecture stayed because they just didn't, there was no economy to rip it down. And then these antique dealers and other people saw how beautiful these houses were and started coming up and buying them for nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, for nothing. People got like gorgeous mansions on Allen Street for like $20,000. Like, yeah. But the town was pretty rough. I mean, you know, my neighbor used to tell me, he used to come to dances here in the 50s with all the little kids. You'd bring your own record. And they'd have all the moms would be upstairs in what was Town Hall. And you could bring your record and they would put the record on. And they'd go around and make the girls and the boys dance further apart and, like, separate them. Anyway. But, yeah. But he said that not long after that, it really became very depressed. Mm-hmm. And, so anyway, a lot of the buildings didn't get torn down, and then in fact were saved, which is really cool. So we have this sort of the bones of a historic town, whereas a lot of other neighboring towns lost that architecture, was lost. So yeah, like I said, other people can tell it better because I don't really understand why, but we do have it, and it's really special. Yeah. The old buildings. And we have a historic preservation committee now and rules on the charter that don't let people just willy-nilly tear stuff down.
Yeah.
They can be a little crazy, though. Yeah. I mean, saving, you know, you're like, okay, but can I paint? They don't have anything to do with paint colors, but it's just, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fine line. It's a fine line. But I'm very thankful that this building and a number of other ones in town were saved.
Yeah.
Next, I think the church up the street needs a new roof.
Oh, okay.
The First Presbyterian.
Okay.
Yeah, that's gonna. I know they've been fundraising and really working hard to make sure that it's a beautiful, beautiful building. To make sure they did the stained glass window in the front a few years. It might be 10 years ago now, maybe less, maybe 5 years. It's gorgeous. Yeah. So, but there's other stuff that has to be saved.
I think that we're probably reaching the end. I could talk for hours with you about this. Has really been like a silver guideline to hear so much about. I mean, you, Hudson Hall in particular, some of the other places on Warren Street. It's the overview. It's really been fascinating to me. Thank you so much. Are there any, it's like, final thoughts as like the best way of being able to phrase it? I guess it's maybe almost like a re-asking of that question that I hit at around the 40-minute mark. What do you want people to know about Hudson or Hudson Hall as, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like we kind of covered most of it. Yeah, I guess we're coming into the 10-year anniversary of having reopened upstairs. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to try to hopefully use it as a moment to retell our story. Yeah. You know, and like I wanted the archive to preserve kind of the history of saving up the building. Mm-hmm. I think it's just an opportunity to kind of benchmark how far we've come and really remember what it took to get here. Mm-hmm. You know, because I do think it's really cool that so many people pulled together to make something happen, and I want to honor that, you know? So, and then there'll be another generation of kids who grow up here. Like, Winter Walk was always so fun because when Santa gives out free books, like Hudson Hall gets all these books donated, and community members come and wrap them, gift wrap them, and then we give them out at Winter Walk. And it was like one year I was just like, it's the third generation of someone who, like, has been coming to Winter Walk and getting a free book. Like, now their grandchild is getting a book, which is crazy to me, yeah. You know? But I kind of love that, you know?
Thank you again. Thank you. Pull the plug.
It's the historian in you.
Yeah, it really is. And yeah, I'm just like someone that's, you know, fascinated with, you know, people who make history, right? Mm, like, and you were, you know, a part of that, of that story. And just thank you. I'll continue after I turn the recorder off. But I just wanted to make sure I had that on thank record. You. Truly, just had a you. We went so many places, and I'm really grateful that you spent some time with me.
Me too. I'm thankful to you. Thank you. Okay.